Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is Congressman Dan Newhouse. The Washington Republican stops by to discuss inflation, government funding, and his Farm Workforce Modernization Act. But first, here's this week's headlines. The Biden administration is pouring $2.8 billion into pilot projects aimed at developing markets for climate-smart commodities in every state and across a wide range of commodities. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack is also increasing the total funding for the initiative to $3.5 billion. That's a big jump from the original $1 billion investment, and $700 million in smaller projects will be announced later this year. But on Wednesday, Vilsack announced 70 projects involving a wide range of farm and environmental groups, as well as minority farmer groups, American Indian tribes, and some of the largest multinational food companies. The projects will be carried out over 5 years and are aimed at producing lower carbon versions of multiple products, including grains, almonds, and biofuels. Negotiators reached a tentative agreement between rail carriers and unions representing their workers early Thursday morning, avoiding a possible strike and keeping billions of dollars worth of cargo on the move. President Joe Biden called the agreement a win for the economy, for the American people, and for tens of thousands of rail workers. Rail carriers spent the week making contingency plans in the event a strike would take place, opting against shipping hazardous cargo, including key farm inputs like anhydrous ammonia. The upcoming harvest and its bounty of grain to move also had farm country on edge. The American Association of Railroads reports the new deal will raise employee wages about 24%. And finally, food prices jumped again last month, partially offsetting the drop in gasoline prices. Supermarket prices rose by nearly 1% in August and are up more than 13% over the past year. Prices for cereals, as well as bakery and dairy products, continued to fuel inflation at grocery stores. These prices helped the consumer price index rise by 0.1% last month, despite gas prices falling by more than 10%. Inflation remains a top concern for Republicans like Washington's Dan Newhouse, who says more needs to be done to combat the issue.
And I think this is on everybody, every American's mind right now as they see prices of virtually everything going sky high, literally. And I hate to over-dramatize the situation, but even though we've seen some softening of fuel prices, gasoline and diesel have come down just a little bit. Food prices in the grocery stores are as high as they've been in a long time. People's paychecks are not stretching as far as they need to. So people are struggling. And even though the fuel prices are down, they're still higher than they were a year and a half ago. I can tell you that costs of production, you know, I'm a farmer, we're picking hops right now at home. I had to interrupt my engagement in harvest time to come back to Washington, D.C. For some votes this week. But I think there's a lot of things that we should be doing to reverse the trends that we've seen in high costs of everything. The costs of production on the farm level increases the costs of production at the grocery store level. A lot of those things, you know, there's a lot of influences, but certainly one of them is the amount of spending that the government has been engaged in over the last year and a half. That has a definite impact on inflation, inflationary pressures. We can control that. We can reduce that. I think that would go a long ways. Fuel prices, we've talked about that. There's a lot of things that we can do to soften the pressures on increasing fuel prices. We need to be energy dominant again. We were before. We need to be very aggressive in making sure that we get to the solutions that are literally right underneath our feet in this country. We have energy sources right here in the United States that we should be utilizing, not going to foreign countries to get the same product that we can produce right here, cleaner and safer than anywhere else. So there's a lot of policies that have been made over the last year and a half that we should be reversing to address the high cost of production, the high cost of food and fuel, and reduce the inflationary pressures.
I want to spend some time talking with you about the Farm Workforce Modernization Act. But before we turn to that, I do want to ask you, borrow on your Appropriations Committee expertise, wondering from the chair you're sitting in, where do we stand on a government funding solution by the end of the month? And sort of as an aside to that, is agricultural disaster spending going to move in concert with government funding?
So it's been no secret to everybody that in Congress and everybody surrounding Washington, D.C., that September 30th is the end of the fiscal year and that we need to have something done by now. It's very frustrating as a member of the Appropriations Committee in the minority that we are no farther along than we were several months ago. I'm hopeful that we can get a continuing resolution. If we can't get the appropriation bills passed, which it doesn't look like the Senate is going to be able to get that done in time. We should be able to, but a CR, a clean CR, is something that I think that we're going to have to look at. It's going to be, my guess is that we'll get something passed at the last minute, pushes us into mid-December. That's kind of what I'm hearing at this point. But it's frustrating. If I hope you can hear that in my voice. We've done the bulk of our Appropriations Committee work in the House. We passed half the bills. We've got more to go. But like I said, these deadlines are nothing new. They've been looming out there for a long time. And it's unfortunate that we have wait to the last minute to get this done.
And just quickly, do you see ag disaster spending moving as part of that CR, or will that be something you'll need to move the discussions on into December?
I think particularly since this is a farm bill, we're leading up to a farm bill year. There's a lot of discussions about ag disasters, what we do, how do we address making funding available for that. And so I think probably there's going to be interest on both majority and majority sides what to do about that. But I have not heard of any solutions coming from the majority at this point on how they're going to address that. It's going to be up to them to decide. And unfortunately, we have not heard yet.
We'll be right back to discuss the Farm Workforce Modernization Act with Congressman Dan Newhouse right after this.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of a space.
Farm Credit helped Rahi build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Every morning, American corn farmers roll their sleeves up and start the work of growing a better future, one bushel at a time, with America's crop. A better future made possible by their unmatched sustainability practices and the extraordinary benefits and uses of corn throughout the global economy. And the National Corn Growers Association proudly supports and advocates for all they do, year in and year out.
Welcome back. Ag labor reform has been a top concern in farm policy for years, but the House of Representatives has taken up and passed twice now the Farm Workforce Modernization Act. Washington Republican Dan Newhouse was the lead Republican on the bill both times it cleared the chamber, and he says he'd like to see some progress on the issue.
This is not an easy subject to deal with. There's so many very hot button issues encased in anything that has to do with immigration reform, and certainly ag labor is no exception. But I think we've been able to address most of them. And there are still a few sticking points left, but frankly, you know, this immigration issue has been dogging Congress for a long time, even before I came to Congress. It used to be that efforts were made to try to get comprehensive immigration reform passed, as you probably well know, never was successful. So we decided to take kind of a piecemeal approach to this. Let's break this up into smaller chunks. Let's try to tackle this in a different way. And we've been successful in the House, taking farm workforce, for instance, been able to pass that twice. It's in the Senate, as you know, and I think we're making good progress. There's a core group of senators that are addressing this and really see how urgent this is. to get accomplished.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as you know, one of the biggest issues is the American Farm Bureau Federation and its opposition to language that they say would allow for lawsuits to come to ag employers on behalf of H-2A workers. Is that an issue that you can get around while still maintaining your Democratic support for this legislation?
You know, the Farm Bureau has been a great partner in this whole discussion, and I have to give them credit for raising some issues that are important to a lot of producers around the country. I think we can get through this. I think that we can find some common ground on that issue. That, as well as the cap to the number of workers that are allowed to let in, that there's more flexibility that's wanted there. So I think we can absolutely answer that question. And if we do, I think we'll see a clear path to victory in getting this bill passed.
Mm-hmm. A number of your Republican colleagues joined you in voting for this bill when it came across the House floor in this Congress, but the majority of the GOP in the House did not vote in favor of this legislation. From your opinion, what do you think it's going to take to get more GOP lawmakers on board with ag labor reform, either in this particular bill or maybe in another proposal? What's it going to take to gain majority support there?
So I think you touched on it before. I think the Farm Bureau is a key partner in this. And I think if we can get their support, and we're getting close to that, I think we're going to see a lot of folks that will come over. One of the things, though, that I think is a huge stumbling block is the situation at the southern border right now. You know, as we see basically an open border with people coming across in record numbers, it's very difficult for some people to support something that they see as bringing more people in. Why do we need to do that if there are so many people already coming? So I think there's an educational process that has to happen here. People have to be comfortable with what we're trying to accomplish. And I'm telling folks that I truly believe that this is one of the things that will help us gain control of our southern border. The things that we have in this bill will reduce the incentive for people to come across illegally. You know why? Because they won't be able to get a job. They won't be able to earn a living. So why come here if you can't do that? That's why people want to come, because they can't find work in their home countries. If you can't find it here either, then it's going to remove some of that incentive. So I think this is one of the key things we need to pass to get a handle on our southern border.
Well, you say this is one of the key things to pass. I'm wondering, in your opinion, what the prospects are for a timeline then. Is this something that you think needs to pass in the current Congress, or is this something that you would be willing to play the political cards that might be dealt post-midterm election and possibly into the next Congress?
I think, looking at the politics of this and how far we've gotten already, Spencer, I think our time is now. The window is open now. I think that this is our best chance politically to get it done. A new Congress, we're going to bring a whole lot of new faces in. We'll basically have to start all over. So I haven't given up hope that we can get this done in this Congress. And I think people are seeing the reasons why it would be a good idea, not only to help secure our southern border, like I just talked about, but it's been proven now that the research has been done that shows having a unstable workforce increases the cost of food. And as Americans see the prices at the grocery store going up so high, this is one of the things that will help reduce that cost. And so I think there's a lot of things that are falling into place that are bode well for us getting this passed.
Congressman Newhouse, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Spencer. Appreciate it.
We'll be right back with this week's panel. But first, a dairy producer checks in with our Hannah Pegel in this week's From the Field.
In this week's From the Field, an Arizona dairy farmer wants to know more about the struggles the industry faces when it comes to using year-round guest worker programs. Take a look.
Hi, my name is Josh Gladden, and I'm a dairy farmer from Buckeye, Arizona. My question is, why can't dairy farms utilize year-round guest worker programs?
Thanks for the question, Josh. The main problem lies with the current H-2A guest worker visa program. Right now, the program only allows farmers to fill seasonal jobs, not year-round jobs, causing a lot of instability for dairy farmers who rely heavily on immigrant labor to milk cows every day. A recent study from the National Milk Producers Federation found 51% of dairy workers are immigrants. It's up to Congress to solve the issue. Last year, the House passed the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, which would change the H-2A visa program to make it available for agricultural work that is not temporary or seasonal. However, senators have been unable so far to agree on a compromise version of the House bill. If you'd like to see your question answered on the show, send an email to newsmakers@agripulse.com. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together, we celebrate together, but we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
At Clean Fuels Alliance America, we're working toward a future of clean energy now that will make our members proud. We serve as the clean fuels industry's primary organization for technical, environmental, and quality assurance programs, and are the strongest voice for its advocacy, communications, and market development. With industry-leading programs and incentives, Clean Fuels Alliance America is actively moving the clean fuels industry forward toward a brighter future.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we're excited to be joined by an expert panel to continue our discussion on farm labor issues. Joined this week by Michael Marsh with the National Council of Ag Employers, Christy Boswell with Alston and Byrd, and Craig Regelbrugge with American Hort. Appreciate all of you taking the time to join us. And Michael, I want to go to you first, because obviously we're seeing a lot of discussion, and we saw earlier this year a lot of discussion in relation to the Farm Workforce Modernization Act. It's a piece of legislation that's passed two consecutive sessions of Congress now. But wondering, how do you handicap the odds of some kind of farm labor package moving in the current Congress?
Well, Spencer, it's going to be very difficult to get something through in this Congress because we're just running out of time. We've been working very diligently with both Senators Crapo as well as Senator Bennett to see if we can craft a more employer-friendly version than what we saw come out of the House of Representatives. And hopefully we'll be able to see the paperwork on that in very short order because, as you know, we're running out of time coming into the elections now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Craig, I want you, I'm looking to hear kind of your perspective on this, because obviously we're trying to figure out how to best, thread the needle between a lot of different competing interests, including the interests of your members. And so wondering, if you could just kind of break down for us, what would the reforms that are included in the Farm Workforce Modernization Act mean for members of American Hort?
Yeah, so our members are engaged in production of very labor-intensive horticultural crops in greenhouses and nurseries, and labor is, labor and workforce employment costs are the single largest cost of production, and we just can't survive without access to a stable and reasonably affordable and productive workforce. Reforms in the bill, as we see it, would bring stability, would bring greater certainty to plan by. We have substantial increases in recent years in use of the H-2A program in the industry. And in some cases, even though the reforms don't go as far as we'd like, they would bring significant flexibility. They would bring much greater certainty to plan by. So we look at the landscape, and it's a tale of two futures, one in which we can continue to innovate and thrive and produce here, and another which were, if we don't get reform done in the near future, where we're struggling, where we're losing economic opportunity in many cases to foreign competitors as nearby as Canada.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Christy, bringing you into the fold here, because as you well know, and as our viewers are learning, one of the main issues that has arisen was a stipulation that the American Farm Bureau Federation had some concern that they were raising about provisions there that might allow for lawsuits to be filed against employers on the part of H-2A workers. Wondering, from a legal standpoint, what do you think that framework would look like if it were to be enacted? What would that mean for agricultural employers?
Thank you for having me, Spencer. And it's a good question. I mean, this is one of the hot topics that is being negotiated in the Senate. I think it is a legitimate and real concern within H-2A users of any increased litigation. This entire discussion is about providing more stability to the sector and the labor market. And any risk of increased litigation, especially in the H-2A program, where there are already robust regulations and protections that are within the terms and conditions of those programs. And the House bill did take strong measures trying to offset some of those risks with mediation. But I think there is still a very legitimate fear that H-2A employers, because of the nature of the program, because they're signing up for a government program, are already a little bit, they would say, targeted on some of the enforcement actions, just because they're putting their business out there. And any increase in that from a cost perspective is a strong concern, and something that I know the ag community and H-2A users are advocating really strongly on, to try to limit that exposure and potentially even eliminate the extension of the Migrant Seasonal Worker Protection Act and the Farm Workforce Modernization Act.
Well, and Christy, what kind of legal action would we be talking about here? What kinds of lawsuits could potentially be filed? You know, if we accept these concerns at face value, what kind of lawsuits are we talking about here?
So currently, H-2A employers have to follow the rules and regulations of the H-2A program. There is the ability for workers to go to the Department of Labor and air their grievances through wage and hour. There's and also wage and hour enforcement, where they go and do investigations on particular operations. And the Migrant Seasonal Worker Protection Act, which is an act that does apply to the migrant workforce around the country, but currently it does not apply to the H-2A program. And that act has additional requirements, some reporting requirements, some additional housing requirements, and it allows for litigation, a cause of action, to be filed in federal court directly rather than through those administrative channels. And like I said, that's a concern. Cost is a huge hurdle in the H-2A program, and there is concern that rather than providing additional protections for workers, which is the intent, I think that there's concern that this will actually just open the door to more frivolous litigation and increase legal costs for employers, even to get that knocked out through mediation or knocked out through a motion to dismiss.
We'll be right back with more from our panel right after this.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Welcome back. The COVID-19 pandemic had impacts across the world economy, including the American agricultural workforce. But as Craig Regelbrugge with American Hort points out, the impacts weren't entirely negative.
First and foremost, in a very positive way, the pandemic shone a bright light on the essential nature of the workforce that sustains agriculture in this country and puts food on our tables. I think there's a growing sense in these tumultuous times globally, certainly including but not limited to the war in Ukraine, that food security is national security. And I think people are starting to realize that having a stable agricultural workforce is a key contributor to food stability, thereby national security, and frankly, food price stability as well. So we're hearing more and more about that in the news. We just finished an employment survey. We gathered a lot of data. We're beginning to go through them, but it's interesting to see employers made major investments and continue to ensure the health and well-being of the workforce. But I really think that the silver lining, the positive, is that the value of the work that's being performed by America's hardworking men and women who are employed in agriculture, I think it's appreciated and valued much more than it had been prior.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Michael, as we discuss the current state of sort of that American foreign-born workforce, wondering what efforts are you seeing on the part of producers, on the part of employers, to try and attract that labor? What efforts are you seeing there?
Oh, there. If you're an agricultural employer, of course, your first interest is try to hire a domestic worker to fill that position. It's going to be much easier for you as an employer. And of course, because once you get into the H-2A program, you've got this whole complex regulatory scheme that's associated with that is very challenging to navigate. However, simply because of the fact that we don't get enough domestic workers showing up on the farm to ask for the job, we're forced to look overseas. And it's important that we have an H-2A program that's functional, that will provide us with workers that are ready, willing, and available to us on the farm so that we can get the job done, so we can feed America and protect America's national security.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as you look at sort of the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic that we were just discussing with Craig, I wonder, given the fact of that pandemic, given the fact of the current labor situation that's resulted due to that and other factors, are we seeing any kind of change in protocol from Immigration and Customs Enforcement in regards to, you know, changes that they might have made?
Well, one of the issues that we ran into, Spencer, was trying to make sure that our workers, if we were attracting them here, had been vaccinated, because, of course, you couldn't transit into the United States absent that vaccination. We were very concerned, as a matter of fact, because the largest foreign workforce that we use on a temporary basis here in the U.S. are coming from Mexico. And when we were working with the USAID and the Centers for Disease Control, we found that many of the vaccines that were being offered in Mexico and some of the rural areas where we typically recruit some of these workers from, unfortunately, did not meet those WHO guidelines, so they hadn't been approved. So that created a bit of a challenge for us. So we worked with some of our colleagues down in Mexico to be sure that we could get them or source them with appropriate vaccinations. And that of course, was a challenge. Now, once they got in country, then you had this kind of hodgepodge of different regulations amongst different states as they were trying to protect that workforce that might be housed with one another or transported with one another to the fields or, of course, after they're done with their workday, staying with one another in congregate housing. COVID sure was a challenge, and I'm really happy to say that actually, the American farmers and ranchers did a terrific job at protecting their workforce throughout the year.
Mm-hmm. Christy, we'll wrap up the conversation with you because all these challenges that we've discussed here, a number of folks looking to still find some kind of solution to the ag labor issue. Wondering, what is your counsel to folks looking to produce that solution? I know it's kind of a million, maybe perhaps even $1 billion question, but is there, legally speaking, is there a needle to be threaded between sort of the amnesty concerns of one side of the discussion and the worker welfare concerns of the other side? Is there a needle to be threaded here?
I think there has to be. This has reached a level, you know, Craig and Michael and I have worked a long time with Ag Workforce Coalition and industry groups across the country who are struggling every day to find workers and to get their crops out of the field, their cows milked. And, you know, the mention of the COVID-19 pandemic, I think that the pandemic, as Craig said, highlighted the essential nature of this work, but also has exacerbated a lot of the shortages and really has brought to the forefront this discussion that has to bypass the political sound bites and focus on the economic need to continue to grow, to harvest, and to provide locally US-grown food products that can hopefully lower costs that we're seeing in the grocery store, that can be safely grown. And it is time that Congress really draws their attention to that. And also, you know, I'd be remiss to say with my administrative experience, there's some H-2A regulations that are coming down the pipe. They just got cleared through interagency review. And depending on, you know, what those final regulations look like, you know, there might be an even stronger impetus from employers knocking down doors on Congress and the Senate to get Farm Workforce Modernization Act to a place where it can pass and to a place that employers can support it.
Well, have you seen some form of ag workforce reform pass through one chamber of Congress? Will it get through both and to the president's desk before the end of the current Congress remains to be seen. But we appreciate all of you stopping by to offer your thoughts on those prospects. Thanks for joining us, folks.
Thanks, Spencer.
Thank you, Spencer.
We'll be right back with more AgriPulse newsmakers. But first, our Hannah Pagel reports on the price changes of a key livestock input in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
As the drought continues to hit the western U.S. and ranchers look at whether they should keep or cull their herds, one of the commodities that is in high demand is hay. Alfalfa hay has been one of the main crops in the desert southwest for decades. It provides high energy and protein for livestock and has a high crop yield when water is available. This year, almost half the hay grown in the country is being grown in an area experiencing drought. That's why the large-scale production of alfalfa is currently in the spotlight due to severe drought in the Colorado River Basin and throughout California. This puts the industry right in the middle of long-standing debates over sustainable water use and the future of farming in the West. This chart from the Department of Agriculture shows the average price per ton of alfalfa hay in California over the last decade or so. As you can see, a corresponding jump in prices has been observed as drought conditions intensify and many livestock feeders struggle to get their hands on a dwindling supply. According to USDA, the season average farm price for hay is expected to be 16% higher this year than the average of the previous 9 years. Input prices in other categories are going up as well, which will tighten producers' margins and limit their ability to take advantage of higher livestock prices. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pegel.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at agripulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the upcoming week. A House Ag subcommittee will hold a hearing to gather stakeholder perspectives on Farm Bill conservation programs. On the Senate side of Capitol Hill, a banking subcommittee plans to examine USDA's rural housing service. And finally, USDA's Equity Commission will hold its third public meeting in a two-day affair scheduled for Wednesday and Thursday. There will certainly be more news that will unfold throughout the week in Washington and across the country, and we'll keep an eye on all of it at AgriPulse.com. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit agripulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.